Welcome to a new season of Kulturdenken, Thinking Culture, the podcast of the IFK, the International Research Center for Cultural Studies at the University of Art and Design in Linz. We are not actually in Linz, we are in Vienna for a very special symposium that I'm truly excited about, titled OLFAK, Sensing Across the Humanities, Science and Arts. My name is Katharina Rahn and I'm at the symposium gathering their thoughts and voices. The research project OLFAK investigates the intervening performativity of smell at the intersection of arts and politics. The project explores how olfactory techniques and technologies are employed in artistic as well as in governmental contexts. Central to OLFAK is the notion that smell can stigmatize, but it can also help us unlearn ingrained social norms, opening up new pathways for reflection and transformation. This is how organizer and principal investigator of the research project, Silke Felber, introduces the symposium.
It is almost exactly 3 years ago that I reached out to some of you with a quite brittle idea that I called olfactomativity. I was just beginning to write on a proposal to have the possibility to work for 5 years with brilliant colleagues about the performativity of smell. So I was applying for a consolidator grant at the European Research Council, and almost unbelievably, it worked out. So the proposal was funded, the vision held, and today, for the very first time, we are gathering here in this amazing room, and I admit that this moves me deeply. Olfactory experience is ephemerally persistent. It is sticky, volatile, and above all, transcorporeal. Crucially, smell intervenes directly as both molecular and symbolic agent, becoming contagious with our biochemistry as well as our sensations, movements, and thoughts. Smell traverses dermatological, neurological, and immunological thresholds, opening us outwards and thereby collapsing the Cartesian dualism of subject and object and body and mind. The project's title, Olfactomativity, from olfaction and performativity, gestures toward long entwinements with colonial, racializing, and environmental violence well established in sensory studies. Yet, OLFAK seeks something further. Crucially, our affective responses to smell can be unlearned or relearned. Neuroscience shows that associative learning shapes how olfactory stimuli are represented in the sensory-specific cortex. And what field could be more suited for such repatterning than the arts? If molecules shift meaning like words, then smell is not only a record of worlds past, it is a medium for worlds yet to come.
And with this rather utopian thought, let's dive straight in and talk about the olfactory. I am speaking with the three organizers of the symposium, Silke Felber, whom you just heard. Silke is professor of the history of knowledge and knowledge of the senses at the University of Arts in Linz. Hi, Silke.
Hi. Freda Fiala, a cultural researcher specializing in Central Europe and East Asia relations. Hi, Freda.
Hi.
And Julia Ostwald, a dance scholar and postdoctoral researcher within the OLFAK project at the University of Linz. Hi, Julia.
Hi.
Could you explain maybe what does it mean to smell? How does it work?
I think what makes smell such a fascinating field of research is that it sits at the crossroads of academic work, then also culture and social memory. So every scent that we perceive basically begins to reach us as a cloud of volatile molecules, tiny chemical messengers that drift through the air. Then they reach our receptors in our noses and trigger patterns in our brains that translate this information to experience. What is crucial is that the way how the experience is translated is widely shaped by the memories we have and the social habits that we have acquired. The same sort of smell compound can signal danger in one context and comfort in another. Smell is therefore never just a chemistry, it is basically chemistry plus history. So when we analyze an aromatic compound, we also trace an afterlife of, for example, plants or industries, colonial trade routes and material practices that are attached to how our perception engages with the molecule and its structure.
Yes, and it even becomes more complicated because we don't only smell on a molecular level. Research is suggesting that we have to use predictive coding models to understand what is happening when we are smelling. So, for example, if we see something, if we have a visual cue, our brain is suggesting a smell. And also, in case that the specific smell does not appear, we have the feeling to smell this kind of thing.
I know the feeling, actually.
And maybe what is also interesting is that in contrast to the other senses, smell is processed in that part of the brain that is the most ancient one and that is related to memory.
Why is it so difficult to describe smell? If I would describe something I see, I can describe the form, the height, colors. Same for sounds, but with smell, I can say it smells good, it smells bad.
Yes, I think this... So there are a few explanations, like always it's complicated, but one explanation is that at least in the so-called Western world or in the global north, our vocabulary when it comes to smell is very poor. This has to do with how we have been trained to conceptualize the world. Mm-hmm. This has to do with Western philosophy, where the sense of smell not always and not from everybody, but very often has been regarded as a kind of poor sense.
I would also like to add that I think this is actually crucial that in how our work relates to the term atmosphere, because if we look to the way how certain social histories are narrated, usually you will find that atmosphere or atmospheric conditions are hardly talked about. If we look, for example, to the cycles of Chinese dynasties, moments of political collapse are almost always tied to environmental conditions. Droughts, harsh winters, crop failures, some kind of strange winds, atmosphere. So literally the air and its qualities, that what transmits molecules, was seen as an indicator in history, in Chinese history, as a sign for cosmic imbalance and social disorder that followed from there. We have parallels in European history. In Austria, for example, during the Bauernkriegszeit, during the Peasants' War in the 16th century, there was the so-called Little Ice Age. The kleine Eiszeit. It didn't just change the weather, it produced hunger, displacement, and a deep social unrest. So climate and air were never neutral backdrops, but actually active forces that shape political and social life. This is the condition that can be analyzed when using olfaction as a method to actually ask the different histories.
So in the end of the 19th century, in the United States, but not only, there were huge smell troubles because of growing industries and so on. Yeah, the so-called great stinks. So cities thought about this problem and tried out different tools and different things. And one of the ideas was to interview citizens about the sources of ugly odors, yeah? And they, so on this basis, they published so-called stench maps to locate the sources of specific odors. And in this context, the olfactory expertise of citizens, of women, of men were considered on the same level like those of chemists, of physicians, and so on. So there was no difference between so-called lay knowledge and scientific knowledge.
So you will be recollecting, but also probably forming a new language, like you already do with new terms like olfactonormativity.
In this way, writing really becomes a new form of challenge. We have to hold each other accountable, and we do hold each other accountable for shifting our ways of writing towards a more smell-inclusive terminology, or towards a more sense-based way of actually communicating. And in this way, we often realize how deeply we are shaped by the ocular-centristic languages and sort of perspective-based ways of seeing and ways of working and writing as academics. And I think that's something that when you become aware of it, you realize that there needs to be intersectional perspectives sort of, and interdisciplinary perspectives that slowly but surely try to grow towards a different way of expression.
Yeah, but this is interesting because we lack of specific vocabulary, but when it comes to stigmatizing, people become very creative to kind of find words connected to smell or to imaginary smells to describe or to other people. Smell is deeply woven into how societies regulate bodies, how they create atmospheres, how they construct identities. And this means on a molecular level, but also on a symbolic level. What we have been trying to do in this project, and I think this is a difference maybe to other projects, is that we look at smells at the intersection of matter and meaning. This means, for example, that we have been also dealing with olfactory substances that are used by the police or military, which kind of stigmatize bodies in two ways. So on the one hand, really on a molecular level, there are substances that stink, so they really kind of settle on bodies, on the skin for at least 3 weeks. This is one side, so social interaction becomes almost impossible because you can't stand the person you're talking with. On the other hand, we don't have to forget that these mechanisms, these governmental mechanisms, also follow a logic which is deeply embedded in history. So if we look, for example, at European travel literature, we find a lot of stereotypes when it comes to specific religious groups, racialized groups, and so on. So these kind of stereotypes get triggered by material substances produced and reproduced by governmental actors.
We look, for example, who is exposed to certain smells, who is protected from them, who controls these smells or who profits from them, and what are the socio-ecological and also the cultural and the art histories that are revealed through such a way of thinking. So in this way, the individual exposure is kind of one side of the question. But the other side, and the side that matters more to thinking about olfactory histories, is perhaps how larger groups of people are actually controlled, managed, and exposed and disciplined through what smell cultures do.
I think it's also quite crucial to emphasize the key differences between seeing and smelling. So one of these key differences, for example, lies in how they organize space and time. So vision relies on stable and measurable coordinates. It gives us perspectives, outlines, shapes, and distances. So more or less a world that feels solid and consistent. Smell, on the contrary, works entirely differently. it unfolds through shifting intensities, which means that it has no clear edges. So smell does not map an environment the way vision does. It tunes us bodily and situationally. Because when we smell, we are always not only open to the world, but we are part of the world. It's a huge step when we talk about questions of climate injustice, for example, of movement, of world making.
Both movement and smell are crucial for shaping the space or how we move through space and how we perceive space.
And it teaches us a lot about thinking about buildings in a more holistic manner. As if you think about air conditions, for example, usually the air that circulates through air conditions, especially in public buildings, reaches the entire space. So if one room hosts an event where a heavy smell is spreading, usually that smell would travel across all spaces and eventually reach spaces that are not supposed to be engaged in the event. What you can sort of imagine from this case is that smell has been a rather, uninvited guest at the level of cultural heritage institutions.
Since when and why do you think is that contemporary art is trying new ways of dealing with the smell or working with smell?
We are all dealing with contemporary art practices. However, we all have a transhistorical approach. You can go back to antiquity and probably even further back. In Greek theater, smell played a crucial role. And if you go on, you find practices through the centuries and everywhere in the world. What is interesting is that in aesthetics, I mean, we were talking about this before, since the 18th century, in many ways, sense was rather denigrated. It was excluded in the discourse mainly, but not so much in the practices themselves. I think dealing with smell became crucial because of several reasons in recent times, because of the climate crisis, but also because of the COVID pandemic. In many ways, in cultural studies and in the arts, air in all its dimensions became a topic.
One of the current developments that our symposium is now not directly engaging with, but something just to keep in the back of listeners' heads, perhaps, is the development of sensory AI. For example, in the context of medicine, there are currently several attempts being made to design so-called artificial noses, devices and softwares that are able to detect illnesses at a very early stage by smelling on your skin and on certain parts of your body where certain organs are located. This is an interesting, potentially futuristic kind of work that is being done, something that is now not at the center of this very gathering, but something that I think as one of the pathways of the future of our work, it may take a relevant scale.
And the interesting thing is that the difference between human smelling and the smelling of e-noses, for example, is not that big because both are based on pattern matching.
I mean, I can give one example that confirms the subtle governmental way it is used and which we are interested in the project. It is a choreography by Arkady Tsaidis, a choreographer based in Brussels, which actually deals with the threat of AI, but relates it also to the Chernobyl catastrophe in that way that both are dealing with disinformation and with not knowing what is happening. And the entire performance is bathed in the scent of lavender. It's not written anywhere. It's just mentioned as a trigger warning that you will smell lavender. So it's not used in an offensive way. It's rather, in a way, amplifies how governmental disinformation and also disinformation through AI is working by calming. It's not that smell is used here as an intervention, but rather on a subconscious layer, repeating how governmental mechanisms are working. Maybe one anecdote which also shows an interesting aspect of what Silke mentioned before, how smell is working. I saw the performance 2 times and I smelled the lavender both times because I read before about it in a review. But afterwards, I spoke to the choreographer and he told me that actually they forgot about putting the lavender smell in the first evening. But I did smell it. I really smelled it.
This symposium brings together scholars from various disciplines. Could you give an overall or first overview about the symposium and the idea behind it?
The cultural history of olfaction is still only partially written. And I think Silke's very fine nose, if I may say that in the metaphorical sense, for this particular gap within this growing and emerging research field has allowed us to locate precisely this context to sort of translate into the framework of our project, asking for the intervening capacity of smell with a specific focus on arts and politics in the Austrian context where the project is situated. So we'll welcome many of those people who have supported the project from the very beginning. And this gathering will give us the extraordinary opportunity that many of those people, most of them, are actually going to travel to Vienna. And we meet together for 3 days of immersive discussions on olfactory conversations.
Which are the disciplines they are coming together from?
There will be colleagues coming from art history, from chemistry, from psychology, performance and dance studies. There are many artists part of the project and also part of the symposium.
Can you say each of you a few words about your own presentation and your own research field?
I will be speaking on camphor, and a substance that was extracted in both crystal and also oil from trees. I'm closely looking towards mainly imported to Europe and the US from Taiwan. When we look at the newspapers from the late 19th century in Vienna, where camphor was actually sort of praised and marketed publicly as one of the potential medicines against cholera, which obviously from today's perspective, we know medically did not have any effects. So my contribution actually picks upon one historic scene where a German journalist strolls around the fairgrounds of the Vienna World Expo in 1873 and describes the Chinese pavilion to have a strong, odorous scent. He describes the gallery to have a scent so strong that one, quote, could expel the moths of the entire world. This historic scene gives us an idea that the gallery space must have given people a really kind of overwhelming sensorial impression. While when we just look at images of it, photographic images that have endured the test of time, we really can't tell the presence of camphor from these images. So my key argument in my contribution is that if we look to the history of camphor, what the pattern that we see is that its history is usually told of one as one of infrastructure and modernization, while at the same time smoothing out the ruptures, the indigenous dispossession, the ecological devastation, and the forced labor that made these infrastructures possible and that were really relevant to this period in Taiwan in the late Qing Dynasty and early Japanese colonial period, where camphor was extracted in militarized camps and people were sort of governed, the mountains were governed by the desire to reach into the forests and cut out the trees. And only by cutting, the scent actually becomes palpable to the human nose. So this is also an interesting dimension, that the scent actually tells you a story of pain and a story of a broken relationship to nature. It isn't, although it may smell pleasant to some and it is marketed as a healing substance, it actually comes from a very harmful process as such.
To both man and nature.
To both man and nature, yes, depending, of course, on whose historic perspective you're focusing on.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I can jump on this. My research is based on the question how contemporary art can deal with climate change. Because there is the recurring argument that we cannot sense climate change, but that it is exactly the arts that have the potential to make climate change somehow sensually perceptible. But if we go back in history from the perspective of the racial Capitalocene, which starts in early modernity, so 15th, 16th century, with, for example, the spice trade, with early or proto-colonial structures spreading around the globe. In this time, so what we now experience actually started, we can say. But it is also the time when smell was broadly used in the arts, and particularly in ballet or in performances that dealt with all with dance and movement, and that were commissioned by in monarchical settings, in economic settings, by merchants, for example, but also in religious settings, by, for example, in ballets by the Jesuits. So actually, this is the framework I am dealing with in my research. I try to find examples in the archives. I'm looking for performances in early modernity that used smell, and I'm interested in how it was used, which function was given to the smell to perform power. If we look at performances today that try to reactivate or reorient the senses so that we can perceive, make climate change perceptible. And often we are all haunted by colonial mechanisms, and also our sensorium is still haunted by colonial structures and by ways we have learned to perceive and to smell, for example. So this is the ambivalence that I would like to show, and which I'm interested in, that art today that is using smells and sensorial practices, how can that happen? Or how can they do this without trapping again in the same orientalist mechanisms that were established during centuries of history?
I can just say that what I will try to do is to follow the smellable traces of the molecule schedule within the logics of capitalism. And I will start from a performative speech act, let's say, from the speech act Merde, so which is used not only in French theaters, I mean right now in the whole world, which means Tui 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 or Viel Glück or In Bocca al Lupo. And you are not allowed to say thank you to it, otherwise it really brings Merd in another sense. Yeah, and I was interested in the specific alchemical magic of this speech act and with the historical dimension. And we don't know this for sure, but I mean, there is evidence that it has to do with the specific situation of theater in the 18th, 19th century, maybe 17th century. So the more horses gather in front of the theater, more people are there, more shit is there, and this is the kind of logic of success. And this will be my initial situation from which I kind of trace this specific molecule, and I will look at specific art productions, contemporary art productions. I will look at Florentina Holzinger's A Year Without Summer, but also what we are now framing as the biggest theater scandal of Austria, namely Heldenblatt from Thomas Bernhard, 1988 in Vienna, where Skatul also played a huge role.
One more question. In the very, very beginning, you said your way of thinking changed through this project.
I mean, what I can say is that my initial idea was to look at the intervening capacity or the intervening agency of smell in different contexts. So maybe at the intersection of what we can call the arts and politics or governmental contexts and the arts. What we figured out together, I think, is that it really makes sense to do this from a trans-historical perspective and from a trans-local perspective. This is not only a shift regarding the focus of the research questions, but also frames the way we are thinking about smell, I guess.
It seems to be somehow an unavoidable side effect that kicks in after a certain period, that you become more sensitive towards the atmospheres of production that are actually enabling certain works to become made or certain materials to become available. So I would say olfaction in a way fundamentally opens a sort of decolonial attention. It opens towards an awareness for patterns of exclusion, may they be racial, may they be class-based, as it translates what is usually considered just an atmosphere just a byproduct and actually centers on those side histories that are not side histories, but are just the histories that are sidelined or sidestepped.
Yeah, and maybe I can add that for me, now that I've been working within the project, or we all have been working on it for 1 year, my perspective on the methodological approach changed in such a way that I acknowledge that it's okay to find only really, really subtle hints, so that it's my task to pick up these tiny notions or annotations. Yeah, it's more to trust these very tiny remarks that you are stumbling over. It's in between the lines, more or less. It's that I'm slowly learning.
Thank you.
Olfak, 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 olfak.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was the first episode of Kulturdenken at the Olfak Symposium in Vienna in December 2025. I've been speaking with the three organizers of the symposium, Silke Felber, Freda Fiala, and Julia Ostwald. Thank you for listening.